It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
It's Friday. That's usually the time I tell you that we are putting together the final pieces for Media Buzz, and hope you have a good weekend coming up. I do hope you have a good weekend coming up, but we have lots and lots of pieces. Let's just say, given the way the hurricane coverage has dominated, there's a lot of things that won't be settled on the show until Sunday morning. Not that I'm whining about that. Live TV is always a rock and roll enterprise, but particularly this week. Once again, I'm going to kind of ease into things just before we... I have so much good stuff here that I am instructing you not to finish listening halfway through, because it toward the end of the podcast got a lot of interesting stuff about the interaction of journalism and investigative reporting and all of that. But I do want to note, and I woke up this morning to this news, that Trevor Noah is leaving The Daily Show after 7 years. He said this to his viewers. Apparently, Variety or one of those Hollywood outlets, was about to break the news. So it sounded like he wasn't really ready to share this. He's not leaving immediately. He says, I realize after 7 years, my time is up, but in the most beautiful way. I've loved hosting this show. It's been one of my greatest challenges, one of my greatest joys, trying to figure out how to make people laugh, even when the stories are particularly, S-word, on the worst days. I never quite took to Trevor Noah as the host of The Daily Show. I do think he's really, really smart. He does stand up around the world. I've heard interviews with him. But as the host, in the early part of it, I felt like he, as coming from South Africa, he didn't really grasp American politics. Then he seemed to fall into the same old, you know, liberals beat up on the right category. And it may just be because I still think of The Daily Show as Jon Stewart's show. He is the one who formed it, created it, forged it. He didn't create it. He wasn't the first host, but he made it into what we think of today as a place that, you know, beats up on the media, politicians, and so forth. Maybe Jon should come back. I'm sure he doesn't want to do that, but he had big shoes, let's put it this way. Okay, LeBron James is investing a lot of money in a hot new sports league, and it's pickleball. Excuse me? You know, I've talked about pickleball before, how it's become such a popular sport, mostly among older people who don't want to do a lot of running. I'm a tennis guy. I see people play pickleball all the time. To me, it's not that much fun to be in a cage, you know, hitting the ball back and forth so quickly. But LeBron, who's already, you know, got interest in other sports franchises, also along with Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors, Kevin Love, the Cleveland Cavaliers, who had once played with James, and some investment group, is buying an interest in a professional pickleball league or franchise. It's kind of weird. I didn't even know there were pro pickleball teams. I know of everything about tennis. So apparently there are these teams. Each team has two women and two men, but they don't represent geographic regions. They're not the New York so-and-so or the LA so-and-so or the Las Vegas so-and-so. The league's events just move around. This year they've been in Austin, Newport Beach, next month Columbus. But it's kind of, I can't think of another sport where the teams just sort of represent themselves and move around the country, but there's no local team to root for. Anyway, LeBron probably knows what he's doing, probably going to make some money on this. Tony Blevins was, until about 2 seconds ago, Apple's vice president for procurement. And he made a video, and he's asked a question about what he'd like to do, or he asked himself, I don't know. Here's what he said. I race cars, play golf, and fondle big-breasted women. That seems to be a reference to a quote in the movie Arthur. Forgive me for not knowing that. And Tony Blevins is no longer the Apple VP. This went viral on TikTok. Not the world's smartest thing to say if you're an executive at a major international company, you think? Okay, let's get down to it, starting with number one, which is, of course, I guess you can now call Hurricane Ian a hurricane again, but it's a Category 1 storm. As I'm speaking to you, it's shortly going to hit South Carolina, which has a lot of low-lying areas, but certainly is very experienced in dealing with hurricanes, and make its way up not along the Atlantic Ocean, but going more inward toward the southwestern part of Virginia. I'm sure the D.C. area will end up with a lot of rain. And the thing is, I have some observations about watching all the coverage, because I've just had to be glued to it. I think now that the hurricane has moved out of Florida, I see a lot of shows that are doing, you know, 15, 20 minutes on the hurricane and then going back to politics or what else they want to talk about. Nicole Wallace yesterday was all about Trump. What hurricane? Her favorite topic on MSNBC. All right, so I see a lot of politicization, which almost always happens, you know, the day after or even the day of a major natural disaster or storm like this. So the politicization runs along these lines. Certain people who are liberal or left-leaning channels, they are saying, look, we're seeing the impact of climate change here. And it turns out, first of all, that you can't tie climate change to any individual storm. But secondly, when you drill down on this and you talk to scientists, it's a little bit complicated as to the relationship between climate change, which is undeniable. Most people accept it as the overwhelming scientific consensus, and the others are climate deniers. But as for the effect on hurricanes, extreme weather, it does. Even scientists who believe in climate change are saying, well, you know, you got to consider this, you got to consider that. So I try to deal with facts. The fact is, in the last 20 years, and I may have mentioned this, there have been more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes in the eastern U.S. than there have been in the previous 40 years. And there's no question, I mean, statistics show the water has gotten warmer. And the warmer the water is, it turns out, the more that these hurricanes can sort of, I was going to say weaponize, they gather even more strength, as we saw with Ian before it made landfall in Florida. But then you have the other side, mostly conservatives, saying, these people are insane. I mean, we don't even know how many people died, and they're bringing up global warming. They have an agenda. And so they are accusing the other side of politicizing it, but they're doing so vociferously and at such great length that you could say, hey, why are you spending all this time saying there's no link or accusing the other? So it's just become the typical thing. One side says this, one side says that. You know, the argument against those who even bring up the impact of the warmer water is, don't do it now, because right now, you know, there's search and rescue going on. There's all this human misery going on. Why are you doing this now? But if you go on for 6-7 minutes about that, then you're doing it too. And it's the classic, you know, each side accusing the other of the politicization game. Another point is, now, first of all, I got to say this. You look at the pictures in Florida, and some areas it is just absolute, complete, total effing devastation. There's no denying it. You look at where the hurricane, as a Cat 4, made landfall. The epicenter seems to have been Fort Myers in Lee County. And you see smashed up boats and you see ruined houses and you see a lot of areas where everything was just torn down, blown away. You see a lot of human misery. And it's just awful. But we don't know at this point. I've seen an estimate now 21 confirmed deaths. We don't know how many people have died. But what happened is a sheriff in the either in the county or a sheriff from one of those towns like Fort Myers within the county said there's going to be, in his opinion, hundreds of casualties. Now, I don't want to rule out that that's possible, but suddenly I heard, you know, everybody repeating it, hundreds of casualties, hundreds of casualties. Well, it's possible that won't happen. There's a lot of search and rescue going on. Ron DeSantis says that I think about 700 people have been rescued in Florida, and they've made contact with about 3,000. So I could be proven wrong here, but it just seems to me a speculative, unconfirmed assertion, kind of hardened into fact. Even Joe Biden said there'll be a major loss of life, and that remains to be seen. Another thing that has bugged me about the coverage is, by the time we got to yesterday, Thursday, you saw individual search and rescue, and, you know, it's great television, you know, volunteer firefighters pulling somebody out of their car or getting somebody to the house as the water level was rising. I mean, some lives have been saved here by the first responders. But since those are individual cases, the pictures aren't as dramatic. The water has receded in Lee County and across Florida. There were storm surges, to be sure. Same thing when it got to Central Florida and Orlando. Same thing when it got to Jacksonville. But because that the pictures, what was happening Thursday just wasn't that gripping, hugely important. My heart goes out to people whose lives were ruined, whose houses disappeared, whose boats were smashed, all that. But every network went back to showing the hurricane from Wednesday. And sometimes it would be labeled Wednesday, and sometimes it wasn't. You know, it'd be in what we call a big little box. You know, somebody talking in the little box, and in the big box you see the devastation of Ian on Wednesday. So that said to me, you know, in order to keep viewers, and obviously I'm sure the hurricane's been very good for ratings, including Fox's ratings, you know, that they had to keep showing the most devastating pictures, even if that meant going back 36 hours. And that kind of bothered me. You know, you can show it a couple times, I guess, to remind people of what happened. But it was just up in a loop. You know, I saw cars mostly submerged in Naples in a parking lot. And by the time the water receded, a few hours later, they were no longer submerged, but there they were, the submerged cars again. It wasn't even still true on Wednesday afternoon, let alone Thursday or Thursday evening. So there's that. And then there's this question of why people didn't evacuate. And as they've been able to interview people, it's, you know, they've interviewed people. I saw one guy interviewed who had his home wiped out in a 2017 hurricane, and the same thing just happened again. And he said something like, well, this is the price you pay for living on the beach. But to some extent, you know, when a federal emergency is declared, the federal taxpayers end up subsidizing this. Like, what sense does it make for people to go back again and again? And when people were asked, why didn't you leave? It's like, oh, you know, I thought the storm surge would just be about 4 feet and I was just going to ride it out. And then it ended up being 7 feet or whatever it was. So a lot of people who could have gotten out, and some people couldn't afford to leave. But there were an awful lot of people who just like, I'm tough and I don't want to leave. Now, some people had a dog or a cat they didn't want to leave. I mean, a lot of explanations. But I think a lot of those people in the Lee County, Fort Myers area ended up wishing that they had gone if they knew then. But, you know, all the government can do and all that the media can do is warn them about what is coming. But, you know, at some point, this is the same debate happened in New Orleans after Katrina. Does it make sense to keep subsidizing people to go live on a beach when you know there are going to be hurricanes there? It's been less true on Florida's West Coast than on the East Coast, but maybe that now has changed. Hey, let's pause right there. The Buzz Meter continues right after this.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
All right, story number two. New court filing by Donald Trump's legal team says that closer to 200,000 pages of documents were seized in the FBI search at Mar-a-Lago. That is a pretty incredible number. 200,000 pages? That's a lot. Meanwhile, Aileen Cannon, the Trump-appointed judge in Florida, who granted his request for a special master, is now overruling the special master whose appointment she made. It does seem like Cannon is doing almost everything she can to protect Trump. I mean, by bringing in the respected retired federal judge, Ray Deary, you're saying, look, I have confidence in this person. I'm appointing a special master, which a lot of people thought was not necessary, which has backfired on Trump to some degree. And then as soon as he does something, she takes his car keys away. So he had said, he's been pressing the Trump team to back up in court what it has said outside of the court realm, which is FBI may have planted evidence, as well as these documents may not have been classified, or he declassified them with a wave of his hand or a thought process. So then Cannon steps in and says, no, you can't do that. You can't ask him that stuff. Taking it off the table, thereby showing that, you know, even having appointed a special master, she is still, you know, I'm not saying this is because she's a Trump appointed judge, but she just, almost everything she does other than having him pay for the review process has been to protect Trump. Another little thing from Trump world, this is one of roughly 150,000 controversies, some of which we've all forgotten about, took place during the Trump presidency. You may recall there was some reporting back in 2019 when Trump was going to Japan. And there were reports that the White House wanted to move the USS John McCain, you know about their relationship, the animosity that Trump felt for the late senator, out of view so it wouldn't upset him. And, well, you know, they said, that's BS. Well, a reporter has finally gotten the documents under the Freedom of Information Act. Took 3 years. And right there in the Navy correspondence back and forth, it says, number three, USS John McCain needs to be out of sight. So the media was right, and any denials from that period were wrong. Another thing from Trump world, former senior advisor Corey Lewandowski has cut a deal with Las Vegas prosecutors after he had been charged, you may remember this, with misdemeanor battery, stemming from allegations of unwanted sexual advances toward a woman during a charity dinner. I think he probably had had something to drink. The woman's name was Trashel Odom. She accused Lewandowski of repeatedly touching her, including on her leg and buttocks, speaking to her in sexually graphic terms. She was the wife of a major GOP donor. Also alleged that Corey stalked her throughout the hotel where the event took place, told her she had a nice ass, and threw a drink at her. So, according to court records, Lewandowski agreed to a deal in which he will undergo 8 hours of impulse control counseling, serve 50 hours of community service, stay out of trouble for a year, and pay a $1,000 fine. As part of that deal, he doesn't have to admit guilt, and the charges will be dismissed. Number three, Vladimir Putin. This is actually quite stunning. Vladimir Putin acknowledged mistakes yesterday and how the Russian government has been carrying out his draft, which shows you how badly the war is going for him at home. You know the last time Vladimir Putin acknowledged mistakes? Never. He never acknowledges mistakes. I mean, maybe in a minor way. So he actually made some television comments saying the draft raised many questions, that all mistakes must be corrected and prevented from happening in the future. He described cases of people entitled to deferments being wrongly drafted, such as fathers of three or more children, men with chronic diseases, or those above military age because they're so desperate to get, you know, 300,000 warm bodies in there. If a mistake is made, I repeat it, must be corrected, he said in a video council with his security council, video conference, I should say, those who were called up without proper reason should be returned home. And this happened after there was violence that spilled into some of the local recruitment offices. And he's got a huge problem on his hands. People in Russia now get it. They get what he's doing with the war. They see the war is going to drag on. They see that many Russians are being killed. I read just the other day that more Russians have been killed in this, what, 6-7 month period of the war than American soldiers were killed during the entire Vietnam War, which was about 58,000. Okay, number four. Peace and Political by Rich Lowry says that President Biden's great political comeback is looking like a dead cat bounce. That's a Wall Street term for it looks like a stock is going to bounce back, but no, it's not. Now, Lowry says the president's up for his midsummer low of approval rating below 40%, but he's still about 42% in the 538 and Real Clear Politics averages. That's a shift from cataclysmic to merely dismal. Better than the alternative, but not enough to transform the midterms for Democrats. The over-optimistic takes from this summer, there was a lot of, you know, look, Biden got all that legislation passed, was that maybe he's pretty good at this. The reality is he is persistently unpopular and an enormous drag on his party, says Lowry, with little obvious upside potential. And despite his protestations, he may end up declaring that he's not running for re-election a year or so from now. And I can't totally disagree with that, given that very tentative answer that he gave to Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes, where, I don't know, I might not, we'll see, what's my intent. Okay, so Lowry goes on to say that he's getting crushed on, in every poll, on the most important issue in these midterms, the economy. Politico poll has him at 35% approval, 61% disapproval on his handling of the economy. ABC, Washington Post, people trust Republicans more on the issue by 16 points. And basically, to the extent that the Democrats are in lead in the generic ballot, which I don't place much stock in anyway, it's despite their feelings for Biden. Now, Lowry says, look, Biden was dealt a weak hand on the economy. Any president elected in 2020 would have had to cope with price pressures and supply chain disruptions, but he has played it badly. So he goes on to, you know, critique his record. And then he says, so Biden's tried to elevate Trump. Trump does loom incredibly large for former president, but isn't on the ballot himself, although sometimes you could be forgiven for assuming he is. Biden simply isn't a dominant figure. He's not bonding anyone to him with his Obama-like charisma. A little sarcastic paragraph here. He's not impressing anyone with his boundless Teddy Roosevelt-like energy. He's not winning over fence-sitters with his Clinton-like triangulation. He's not taking the edge off the opposition with his Reagan-like humor. He's just pretty much a straight partisan Democratic president with no particularly notable talents or appeal. And Lowry wraps up by saying Biden is fast approaching quasi-lame duck status. Pretty extraordinary, but everyone knows he's about to turn 80 and can see that reflected in how he does his job. And that ABC Washington Post poll, only 35% of Dems and Dem-leaning independents want Biden to run for a second term, which is about as bad as it was, you know, back before he passed all that legislation and things seemed to be looking up. Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this. All right, now I want to get to number five. And this is what I was kind of teasing at the top. So a little bit of a scoop from Maggie Haberman, the New York Times reporter whose book Confidence Man is officially out next week, but a lot of organizations have gotten it and are strip mining it, that Donald Trump, as president, threatened internally to go after her phone records in order to expose leakers. Quote, Trump, angry about my published stories, would bellow that he wanted administration officials to obtain my phone record and identify my sources. It did not appear that anyone ever acted on it. Well, guess what? Looking at all the publicity that Maggie's book has got, Donald Trump has weighed in on Truth Social. And remember, he had granted her three different lengthy interviews for the book. The first one, she says, he asked for before she could even ask. And she says, she revealed that he said, I love talking to Maggie, talking to two of his aides. She's like my psychiatrist. Trump, here we go again. Another fake book is out. This one supposedly very boring and stale. Supposedly, meaning he hasn't read it. By self-appointed headcase. Headcase, failing unfunded liability, New York Times writer, Maggie Haberman. Hagerman, he writes. Is that a typo or just a kind of a slap? In it, she tells many made-up stories with zero fact-checking or confirmation by anyone who would know, like me. Now, you know, you can have your opinion on Maggie Haberman. Ultimately, you can decide whether her book is any good. What do you mean, zero fact-checking? She interviewed you three times for a long period of time. Not only that, but, and this was Maggie's response. She posted, I mentioned this, I think, the other day. Just as she was past her deadline to make changes in the book, she sent him questions, and he would send it back, and she posted a picture of this with his notes saying, fantasy question, this never happened, might be some truth in this one. So she did fact check with him. In one case, she lies about me wanting to fire my daughter Ivanka, and Jared, wrong, pure fiction, never even crossed my mind, just have to fight troublemaking creeps like Maggie and all the rest. Well, first of all, this just means he doesn't agree with it. But obviously, John Kelly, if he was the direct source or not, either told her or told people that Trump pushed him to fire his daughter and his son-in-law so that he, Trump, didn't have to do it, talked him out of sort of firing them by tweet, and now he's calling Maggie a creep and a head case. What happened to, she's like your psychiatrist, you love talking to her. Okay, so Politico has like a million-word profile of Maggie, and I'll just read a couple of the quotes. She's talking about, you know, having her life dominated by dealing with Trump. Maggie says to the reporter, if I went and covered something else, do you think I really get away from this? Even if I did move on, she said, I don't get to move on because at this point, I am so publicly associated with this story. So until he stops being a story, I think I'm stuck. So what do I want? Some sleep. I just want some sleep. Are you addicted to this work? Yes, 100%, Haberman says. I think you knew the answer to your question. It is my curse and my salvation. In other words, Trump kind of made her famous, attracted all his attention, was part of a Pulitzer Prize winning team, but she also feels cursed by having her life so much intertwined for so many years. You know, Maggie Haberman, for those who don't know, is the daughter of a mom who worked for the New York Post and a dad who at one time, I believe, worked for the New York Post, Clyde Haberman, who later became City Hall bureau chief for the New York Times and then a columnist for the New York Times. So this is in her DNA, but not necessarily to have her spend her life on Donald Trump. Anyway, that leads me to John Harris, co-founder of Politico, writing about the reporters like Maggie Haberman and others, Jonathan Martin, Alex Burns, and others. And basically the case that Harris makes is, I've known these reporters for years, decades, and they basically believe in traditional journalism, that the younger ones came up through places like Politico, which Harris helped found to kind of get away from the old model of, you know, the voice from God kind of reporting. And others came up in the traditional legacy newsrooms, as Harris did during his many years at the Washington Post. He said their most important similarity is a mania for reporting far exceeding the typical journalist. And he goes into some examples. He says, when I shared the White House beat at the Washington Post with Peter Baker, because he mentions Peter Baker and his wife, Susan Glasser, who just published a book about Trump, he used to cold call officials he didn't know at their desks just to see what might turn up. He's the kind of kind of reporters who can make colleagues wonder if we are in the right line of work, meaning because they're so good. All the work here involved establishing credibility and confidence with scores of sources with diverse motives and political orientations. They succeeded because these sources had every reason to trust their traditional professional standards. But they're not bland, or they're not unwilling to make sharp interpretive judgments. That's how they differ from maybe the earlier generation. Naturally enough, different reporters have different styles, Harris says. Peter Baker has said he doesn't vote in elections as a way of ensuring his mind stays open. Glasser, his spouse, as well as co-author, is outspoken in social media and other settings about her alarm of the way Trump is eroding democratic norms. She says, the man is not charming. He is a self-absorbed, rambling narcissist, old man, who doesn't care what your questions are. Interesting. Anyway, Harris concludes by saying this. It's a myth that traditional journalism ever required studied neutrality. Journalists are not neutral, nor should they be, on elemental questions in a democracy. We favor disclosure over secrecy, honesty over propaganda. It turns out the old ways, you know, the younger, there's a younger woke generation out there who is like, look, we don't care about traditional journalism. It's too wimpy. And we believe that we have to take a stand, and often it's taking a stand against conservatism and Donald Trump. And that's produced a clash in many newsrooms. But it turns out traditional journalism, at least according to Harris, and I agree, still has plenty of life. Not just these books, but the reporting. I mean, look, some of the reporting was outrageous. You know, the Russia investigation was legitimate, but was so outrageously and constantly hyped by the mainstream media as to raise serious doubts about their credibility. A lot of these organizations became part of the resistance. And now some of them are trying to win back their credibility. We'll see about that. So once again, Friday, putting together the show. Don't know what we'll end up with, but we'll have a lot of interesting stuff on Media Buzz. Hope you're heading into a fine weekend. Appreciate your listening, as always. Back here on Monday with more BuzzMeter.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.